Good morning and welcome to Senate Finance. Today we're going to have a presentation from the Mental Health Trust Authority with Jeff Jesse. Present at the table are Senator Fairclough, Senator Bishop, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Olson, Senator Meyer, and Senator Huffman, as we are told, is on his way. He'll be here shortly. But we're going to go ahead and get started. And Jeff, if you could come up, or Jeff, yeah, come up and begin your presentation, and you have the floor.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Huffman is, for the record, Senator Huffman is present.
For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and with me is the Vice Chair of my board, Mike Barton, and he'll start off.
Go ahead, Mr. Barton. State your name and association for the
record. Mr. Chairman, I bring greetings from our chair, Dr. Doolittle. He's unable to be here today. And Greg Jones is with us, who is the executive director of the Trust Land Office. They manage our non-cash assets. And then we have two other trustees with us today, Paula Easley and Russ Webb. The other trustees that are not able to be here are Lorraine Durr, Larry Noreen, and Mary Jane Michaels. We have, look, our plan today is that I'll go over some general introductory stuff, and then Jeff will give you the real poop.
Fair enough. Go ahead.
First slide, who are the beneficiaries of the trust, and you can see here who they are as defined in statute. That people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. The guiding principles of the trust are, you can see on the screen, these are the principles that guide us in our decisions regarding investments and expenditure of trust funds. So we're particularly proud of our program evaluation efforts, and you have, I think in front of you a scorecard that we use to evaluate our programs. We also spend a lot of time in prioritizing our services, trying to, I think very similarly as you in your efforts here, and try it so that we get the most bang for the buck. The trust has statutory advisors. These are advisors that are set out in statute. The Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, the Mental Health Board, the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Ed, the Alaska Commission on Aging, and the Commissioners of Health, Social Services, Revenue, Natural Resources, and Corrections. And they're all very important to us as we shape our programs. A couple of our partners are the Alaska Brain Injury Network and the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council. The trust funding in fiscal 14, the payout from the endowment is $18 million and 3.7 in prior year monies. Income from the land office, which Greg shepherds, is 3.2, and interest on various accounts is $650,000 for a total of 25.6, which will be available in fiscal 14, or is available for fiscal 14. The trust resource portfolio. The trust was originally established in 1956 in federal law, and for various reasons it that largely dissipated, and then in 1994 was reconstituted. And you can see on this slide the million acres of land that the trust that was put into the trust. And you can see at the top there the distribution acreage by region, and then in the second pie chart there, our ownership interests in those lands. And particularly significant is that our full fee ownership is only about half the land. The other interest is subsurface. And the significance of that is that if we can't develop the subsurface, it might as well not be in the trust. That's always in our minds as we make decisions and going forward. The contributions to the Trust Land Office over the years have totaled $138 million since the reconstitution in 94. We use a formula for success in addressing various health issues, and you will see the application of this formula as we go forward. There are five program areas that the trust invests in, particularly, and bring the kids home, which is an effort to bring back the kids from the lower 48 that were being treated there and have them treated in Alaska. Disability justice, affordable appropriate housing, workforce development. There's a chronic need for providers in this field, as you well know. And then the Beneficiary Projects Initiative, and this one involves peer-to-peer programs. And we're also looking at alcohol initiatives, Recover Alaska, and we're also participating in the Title IV review that's ongoing at this time. But with that, I'd like to ask Jeff to lead us through the focus areas and more detail of the actual budget.
Go ahead, Mr. Jesse.
And, of course, I encourage you to ask questions as we go. I'm sorry.
Jeff, if you don't mind, from the presentation that Mr. Barton gave, do any of the members have questions?
Sure.
Hearing none. Go ahead, Mr. Jesse.
Okay, great. Well, let's start with Bring the Kids Home. As some of you are well aware, back in FY06, FY05, FY06, we sent 743 Alaskan kids out of state to expensive RPTC residential psychiatric treatment facility programs at a cost of over $40 million to the state. It was during the Murkowski administration that Joel Gilbertson and the chief of staff talked to the trust about, look, we don't want to keep sending these kids out of state. They're not only is it expensive, but they're being taken away from their communities, away from their homes. And so we started working with the administration at the time and has carried on through the subsequent administrations to try to knock down this problem. For some of you that are new to the trust, the best way I can describe the role of the trust in these types of initiatives is the venture capital for these efforts. As you can see from our funding availability, we don't have the resources to fully fund the state's mental health program, but what we can do is work with you and the executive branch and develop more effective, cost-efficient ways of serving Alaskans with mental health issues. So we started working on this. If you remember the formula for success, and you'll hear this over and over during the presentation, you know, the first thing we do is to identify what the problem is, and as Mr. Barton said, we try to focus on what is the ultimate outcome we're trying to achieve. and then pull our partners and the stakeholders together. We've found that if any one piece of the system tries to solve these problems on their own, they rarely get it right, whether that's a state department or a tribal entity or the trust or the provider community itself. So a lot of our work is in convening all of the proper partners in the room and let that dynamic produce the best thinking about not only how to try to achieve those outcomes, but specifically how to measure whether we're making progress towards them. So what we did with Bring the Kids Home is you can see the list of partners that we brought to the table. We started thinking about what is it going to take to stop sending these kids out of state. Obviously, that's developing resources here in the state. You'll see in a minute that has to be a pretty comprehensive approach, not only just getting services, but we needed a qualified workforce in order to provide these services. So how did we do? How are we doing? You can see from this slide that we have dramatically decreased the number of admissions to out-of-state RPTCs. Again, when we started, there were 437 kids in out-of-state placements. We're now just under 100. And we've done that by reinvesting in services here in Alaska. The other thing that we track is recidivism. It doesn't do a lot of good to get kids back or to get them into RPTC level of care if you spend a lot of money on them for a while, put them back in the community, and they aren't successful. You see this most dramatically in the corrections budget, where recidivism is a huge driver of the overall costs in that area. We have been able to reduce the recidivism rate for youth going back into RPTCs within 1 year from 20% to 5%. That's a significant improvement. You can see from this slide how our reinvestment strategy has played out. On the most intensive services, the residential psychiatric treatment centers, you can see the solid set of bars at the bottom are the out-of-state RPTC costs. And you can see how dramatically those have decreased from, again, the $40 million we were spending now down to around $14 million a year. Now, the transparent bar above that is the in-state RPTC. Now, there's been some modest growth in that, but remember, our plan was not simply to replace expensive institutional care outside with equal or more expensive inpatient hospitalization in-state. So that's been held relatively constant through the program. You can see, however, that the community-based services, both in terms of Medicaid and general funds, have gone up. Now, we believe that this is about a cost-neutral effort over these years. In other words, we're not saving you a lot of money.
Ms. Jesse, can I interrupt you just for a moment? I'm sure you mentioned it, but I didn't catch it. What is RPTC?
Oh, Residential Psychiatric Treatment Centers.
Thank you.
We haven't necessarily saved you a lot of money, but we have reinvested those dollars in-state, and we have stopped the expansion that we were seeing for, frankly, 7 or 8 years before the initiative started, where out-of-state RPTC costs were going up at a very steady pace on a path that we felt was totally unsustainable. Now, what we've done now, as I said, we started with 437. Now we're down to just under 100, right around 100. So what the Division of Behavioral Health did is we started looking at this last 100. Because when you undertake an effort like this, one of the things you start to realize is it probably isn't practical or cost-efficient to think that we're going to build an absolutely perfect continuum of care such that no children will ever need to be sent out of state to residential psychiatric treatment centers. Well, why is that? Well, some are have such specialized needs that trying to develop those kinds of specialized programs in Alaska just isn't cost-effective, if practical at all. So we started looking at who are these last kids that are still out of state. And you can see that they tend to have multiple issues. They have intellectual disabilities in addition to severe emotional disturbances. Autism spectrum disorder is an issue. FAS is also an issue. So we've been looking at what programs are there that we might still be able to replicate here in Alaska. Most recently, the Trust has worked with the State Department of Health and Social Services. We found a program in Maine, which is an inpatient program that's very intensive services for this population. They currently, those types of kids, again, with autism, severe emotional disturbances, FAS, often with behavior issues, that make it difficult for them to stay in their home or even in a residential program. What this program does is it's very intensive on both communications and behavioral management.
Can I interrupt you again? Excuse me. I hear this word complex behaviors, collaborative, and I'm not exactly sure what complex behaviors are. I've had them described to me, but if you could go just a little more in depth, because I'm hearing that word a lot. I think we're probably going to be dealing with it
absolutely
throughout our time here.
Complex behaviors are things like acting out. Either it's eloping, running away. It could be self-injury. It could be being combative with either caregivers or other residents in a program or family. It's basically behaviors that the current environment seems unable to manage effectively. And what it often does is if those behaviors don't get managed, then that individual blows out of that placement, whether it's their home or an assisted living facility. And so developing state-of-the-art evidence-based behavioral management plans and training for people and families so they can manage those behaviors is absolutely critical.
Okay. Go ahead.
So with this program in Maine, the kids we have outside now with that constellation of problems are spending over 400 days in these out-of-state treatment facilities, an average length of stay of over 400 days, and they're coming back not, frankly, a heck of a lot better off than when they left. And so what the program in Maine does is it's a very intensive inpatient program with an average length of stay between 45 and 90 days. So right there, you're dramatically reducing your cost for that high-end care. But that's not the most important thing. The most important thing is how the program connects to community-based services, whether it's the family or a residential provider. Now, the main program actually discharges two-thirds of their clients back into the home. Not into some other residential program, but back into the home. And they do this by not only developing these behavior plans, but they bring the family in from the very beginning. The family shadows, they call it shadowing, they shadow the staff as they develop these behavior programs. And then they actually come in and run the program for their child in the facility before discharge. And then after discharge, the staff remains available to consult with the family or the residential provider. They have a recidivism rate of under 10%, which for this level of issue is really quite phenomenal. We've engaged North Star, which is a residential provider in Anchorage, to look at doing the inpatient piece, and then we're working with community providers on how to match that up with folks in the community. And again, just to give you an example of how the Trust facilitates this is, as you can imagine, it would have been difficult for Health and Social Services to have gotten six or seven of their people on an airplane and fly them to Maine. let alone the department paying for North Star people to go and community providers to go. Well, that was a role that the trust fulfilled, is we spent the money to get people there so you can see the program hands-on. There are actually a couple of different teams that are going there at different times, and so again, we are looking at that. However, Bring the Kids Home is clearly winding down. We are getting pretty darn close to what we think is pretty much the irreducible minimum that's cost-effective and programmatically practical for Alaska to do here in the state. So there will always be some kids that are going to end up going out of state for some period of time. There is more that can be done in two ways. One is better coordination with families and programs here in Alaska when they do go out, and also working farther upstream so that we don't end up with these kids getting taken out of their homes and communities in the first place.
Mr. Jesse?
Yes.
What are the age limits we're talking about here?
We're all the way down from 8, 9 years old, some, occasionally maybe a 7 year old, up to young adults, 18, 19, 20.
And maybe I missed it if you talked about it, but what happens at the end of that time period? How do they get handed off?
Well, for many of the kids that have gone through the Bring the Home program, the goal is to transition them into life.
Oh, okay.
That's why you'll see some proposals for transitional services. You know, what we don't really want to do is just transition them into the adult mental health system. I mean, that's not the objective. However, for many of them, they do need to transition into the adult system because they need ongoing support and probably will for the rest of their lives.
Thank you.
Sure.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jesse, I guess the question, I'm assuming then that there is no age limit for these patients as they get older. And I guess my concern is, are they ineligible for Medicaid once they get to a certain age?
No, they're Medicaid, Senator Olson through the chair, no, they're Medicaid eligible isn't dependent upon that necessarily. It's their disabling condition and, of course, their financial status. So, so you're right. In the sense, there's no age limit. You know, they are people we need to work with at all ages.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Mr. Jesse.
So this is what we learned when we started digging into a lot of these kids, not just this last group I talked about, but frankly all the kids that end up getting sent out of state or into higher levels of care in Alaska. What we know, and you probably heard this and you will hear a lot more about it in the coming years, is adverse childhood experiences. You'll hear people talk about ACEs and ACEs scores. And what we have found is that, and you know, you would think, well, gee, this isn't exactly the discovery of fire, but we've discovered that, gee, the more negative experiences a child has as they're growing up, the greater the likelihood that they will end up with long-term behavioral health issues, whether it's substance abuse, mental health issues. If you look at suicides, you know, people that commit suicide tend to have many adverse childhood experiences. Now, why is this so important to get a handle on? Well, one thing we've learned is that high ACE scores don't just indicate you're going to have behavioral health problems. It turns out you can predict physical health problems based upon high ACE scores. Everything from diabetes to heart disease. This is a very important information, I think, for all of us to digest, because what it will allow us to do is really target our prevention efforts at where we believe we can get some positive impact. You know, the challenge with prevention isn't that we don't know how to do it. It's being able to target those efforts sufficiently to deliver enough intervention to change the trajectory. That's what you're after. And if you can't identify the target population, you can throw a lot of money out there trying to prevent things, and at the end of the day, not necessarily have a lot to show for it. So understanding adverse childhood experiences and how to mitigate them I think is in the long run, for example, when you start talking about, well, how are we going to sustain this health and social services budget for the next 10 or 20 years? Well, it's going to be in getting farther up the chain and starting to intervene more effectively earlier and partnering with our schools. Our schools are clearly the most effective early warning system we have because most of these families are not good self-reporters. And so that's going to be very important as we move forward. Now, where are we with the budget looking forward to the last couple of years of Bring the Kids Home? Well, you can see we continue to commit Mental Health Trust Authority authorized receipts. You can see the shift here, as was mentioned earlier, some effort in transitional aged youth.
Could you walk through the acronyms there, that BTKH, please?
Yes. BTKH is Bring the Kids Home.
Oh, okay.
MTAR is Mental Health Trust Authority Authorized Receipts. And just to refresh your memory, that was a very carefully chosen term. The legislature does not appropriate trust funds. You authorize agencies to receive trust funds that the trustees have authorized for that use, just with federal funds, just as you do with federal funds. GFMH is General Fund Mental Health. Let me see if there's something else I can confuse.
I think you've covered it. That's fine.
Now, one thing you will see is the difference between what the trustees recommended in terms of trust authority funding and general funds and what the governor recommended. What the trustees proposed for this coming year is a one-to-one match on trust funds versus the state funds. As you can see, the governor has reduced the request for general fund mental health. We'll be working with Senator Olson and the subcommittee on this, but my direction at this time is to continue to maintain that one-to-one match. So we'll be discussing how to put this budget together when we get into the subcommittee. Again, looking forward to 15, looking at continuing to transition the ongoing successful projects from trust funding to GFMH, continuing to build on our success, and again, shifting the focus away from dealing with the highest end problems, but backing up into local communities and families, targeting resources to head some of these issues off before they get to the point where we're spending a lot of money. The next focus area I'll talk a little bit about is disability justice. Again, 43% of the youth in the juvenile justice system and 42% of incarcerated adults are trust beneficiaries. Our goal is to drive that number down. We're very pleased at the cooperation and leadership, frankly, being shown by the Department of Corrections. Their focus has clearly become looking at everything they can do and get their partners to do to reduce recidivism. Not only are a large number of inmates trust beneficiaries, but they recidivate at a higher rate than individuals without these issues. So we're working very hard at each level of the system. Now, again, our formula for success, how do we go at this disability justice issue? Well, the first thing we do is we pull our partners together. Now, these are a different set of partners in part from the partners we have on the other focus areas. But as you can see, it's built on the same formula. Get the right people to the table and start identifying what your goals are, how you're going to measure those outcomes, and start to develop strategies to turn the curve. So what was our strategic thinking when we got all these people together? Again, trying to prevent and reduce inappropriate arrest, prosecution, and incarceration. So that's at the front end. If we can keep them out of corrections or juvenile justice at the front end, well, that's the best thing. Also looking, however, at how can, if they do get in the criminal justice system, how can the criminal justice system deal with them in a more effective way for long-term ability to keep them out of the criminal justice system? Next is to reduce the use of jails to provide protective custody holds. If the police find somebody or get called for somebody that's extremely intoxicated, they end up taking them to the jails. They clog up the jails. They use disproportionate amounts of public safety resources that really should be used for actual criminal behavior, not these protective holds. And then finally, and perhaps most importantly, is improving the reentry planning, both from juvenile detention and adult correctional facilities, so that they are successful in leaving corrections and don't just cycle back in through the system again. So just a couple of highlights of outcome-driven results. For example, looking at the protective holds, we worked with the Bethel area to help them develop a place to take people when they need protective custody at a much lower cost and better service, frankly, than the jail. And you can see the dramatic impacts from this, a 75% reduction in non-criminal Title 47 protective holds at the correctional center. So again, these are the kinds of outcomes that we're measuring. Same thing on therapeutic courts. In looking at how can we treat people more appropriately when they do get in the criminal justice system. The therapeutic courts have been very successful. The court system clearly has come around on this. And I'll tell you, when we started with these mental health courts, I think it's fair to say that the court system as a whole was at best skeptical. In fact, some of them referred to them as boutique courts, and that was not a term of endearment. However, by rigorously evaluating the results of these courts, the court system has come around to understanding that, yeah, these things may take some more resources on the front end, but it is paying off because we aren't seeing these people over and over and over like we used to. And how are we doing that? Well, the therapeutic courts get people connected to case management. They get them connected to treatment. Perhaps most importantly, they try to get them connected to housing.
Jeff, could you stop just for a moment? Senator Hoffman, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the mental health program in Bethel is working quite well, but the question that I have, that you say on page 20 that non-criminal Title 47 protective custody holds, but they are criminal, they are being arrested, and they are being incarcerated. Do you see a need to change Title 47 so that that your statement there of non-criminal arrests for public disorder or drunken in public be addressed?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, there is a possibility of doing some modification of the protective custody statutes. I will say, though, that the decision that police officers often have to make at the front end is a very difficult one. For example, one officer could see somebody in a doorway that's very intoxicated and see someone that needs a non-criminal hold. Another officer sees a trespasser that they're going to take to the jail and charge with trespassing. So I think the issue is more about giving the system options, better options, than necessarily trying to drive it through legislative action. However, we're certainly willing to look at that area and see if there are some things that we can do to tweak that.
Because in Bethel, if I might continue, Mr. Chairman, the community has struggled with the Title 47 protective custodies, and it has clogged up the system for the state of Alaska. And in Bethel, I know the Yukon Custom Correctional Facility is well over 200% capacity. And, you know, that is a separate issue that needs to be addressed. But it seems to me that we are ignoring the law and skirting around the issue by leaving that on the books and trying to address the individual, and they should be treated in a different category if, in fact, this is a disease and they are being incarcerated because of it.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Jeff, could you do me a favor? Could you put together what you would think the answer to Senator Hoffman's question is and provide that with what you think the costs would be?
Certainly, Senator.
Thank you.
I'd be happy to do that.
I know the 4th Judicial District, which starts in Fairbanks, and Judge Doug Blankenship is very concerned about some of the issues that are happening in your region, Senator Hoffman, and I think some progress was made a couple of years ago, but it persists. There is an answer. It's probably going to come from you guys, so if you could provide that to Senator Hoffman's office, and Senator Hoffman, if you could share that with the rest of us, I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jesse, as we talked about some of the issues related to Title 47 and the complexities that go on in the development of society, what's going on in Kotzebue where you've got no active way of a holding area, especially with the state and their responsibility that goes along with that, and how do you protect some of the mental health as well as the incarcerated people that are out there? What is the latest on that right now, and what do you see as a solution that we as the state need to provide to make sure that the citizens of the state of Alaska are taken care of, whether they have mental health problems or not?
Well, Senator Olson, through the chair, as you know, Nome has currently got a new hospital. My program officer, Steve Williams, has spent a lot of time out there working with the Health Corporation and the community at taking the old hospital and turning it into a wellness center, where you could have not only a sobering center like we have in Bethel, but also start looking at treatment and getting those folks engaged in some kind of a positive program. So as you know, there's been some turnover at the Health Corporation, and I think that slowed the pace of progress a little bit. But in our view, turning that old hospital into a wellness center would go a really long way to helping that region, not just the people in Nome, but from surrounding communities, have access to some services and try to knock down this problem.
Mr. Chairman, if I could continue.
Senator Olson.
So if my friends and relatives out of Shungnak, if they have somebody that has some type of inebriation or a problem that's there, that may be minor, why do they have to go all the way to Nome, where you could have a facility there in Kotzebue that can hold them either under Title 47 or it can go ahead and address some of the mental health issues that may be just on the surface, and there may just be a breakdown of medication adjustment or even complying with the medication regime that they've been put under?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I couldn't agree with you more. The more we can push services and strategies out into smaller communities, then the better service people will get, and we won't end up with them congregating in larger communities. It's frankly a matter of resources and triage. As you know, we've been longtime supporters of the Behavioral Health Aid Program. We're currently funding the development of the Behavioral Health Aid Manual that will be patterned after the Health Aid Manual. Getting those types of services in smaller village settings is very important. In addition, and in fact, Kotzebue is a leader in this area in telemedicine, using video to assist behavioral health aides or village-based counselors in dealing with emergencies in their community without transporting them to larger communities.
Last question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
So I can, it's a yes or no question, really. So I can assume that I have your support when I go to corrections and ask them to try and resolve the Kotzebue jail situation, that you will be there to testify on my behalf, or at least be there to say something on my behalf that will help the people in my district?
Yes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, a question, and it kind of goes to what I had mentioned earlier when you were talking to Senator Hoffman. Kotzebue is not in the 4th Judicial District, is it?
No, it's in the 2nd.
It's in the 2nd, okay. It might be a good idea to bring the presiding officer of the 2nd Judicial District. I know it was very successful model when we brought Doug Blankenship from the 4th into dealing with some of the social work problems that were happening in Bethel. That actually, Senator Hoffman, in case you didn't know, that came from a conversation that he had with me at a New Year's party long after I had left the Senate, and the guy really cares. But it was a good synergy to bring the mental health community, the political arm, and the judicial arm together to work on that problem. It's a pressing problem, and I would just encourage you to include the judicial branch in your discussions as well to try to come up with a model that works.
Well, Senator, I appreciate that. Convening is one of the things that the trust does well. And I'm certain that my program officer, Steve Williams, behind me is taking notes on this, and we will see what we can do.
And my question, too, a little further, is on capital expenditures, because what Senator Olson is talking about certainly envisions some capital expenditures. The trust's role in capital expenditures like that, is it the same thing, like kind of a match thing, or do you guys just build facilities from your own trust?
Yeah, Senator, we don't have the resources to be a major player on the capital side,
okay.
But we often do relatively small capital grants in the $50,000 to $100,000 range, and frankly, a lot of the reason we do those grants is many other funders look to the trust for an indication as to whether a capital project relating to mental health is something that should be funded. In a sense, it's sort of a good housekeeping seal of approval. In fact, we regularly get calls from, say, the Rasmussen Foundation saying, look, we're not going to pursue this capital project unless you guys have some skin in the game. So we are a relatively small funder. However, we do two things that I think are very important around capital projects. One is we are partners with the Denali Commission, the Mattsu Health Foundation, and the Rasmussen Foundation in the pre-development program. Some of you may have heard about this. There's been presentations here in the legislature. What this is when one of the funders is interested in a project, they refer them to the pre-development program, which is housed at the 4-acre group, where they are able to get training and technical assistance in how to put a capital project together. You know, a lot of our nonprofits are not in the building business. They're in the human service business. And through the pre-development program, they're able to understand what they're getting into with a capital project. They are encouraged to think through, well, how are you going to run this thing? How are you going to pay for the lights and the heat? If it's a bigger building and you're going to have more services, how are you paying for the services? What are you going to do about a sinking fund for ongoing maintenance and repairs? And a number of projects fall out of the pre-development program because the boards and the people that work for the agency finally realize that this dog ain't going to hunt. And you might think that's a failure, but we don't think that's a failure. We think that's a success because having people drive forward with these capital projects without having a business plan that's viable is more harm than good. And we have certainly encouraged the legislature to look similarly at how you might have a system that more carefully vets capital projects before, frankly, you end up throwing money at them.
Thank you, Jeff.
So looking ahead for FY14 in the Justice Initiative, you'll see the largest GFMH increment is the $1,165,000 that's needed to sustain the wellness court capacities. That's absolutely critical if we're going to maintain the gains that we've made. And I know this is a difficult year to look at a significant GF increment. But again, without that, many of the wellness court systems that we put in place are going to get dismantled, and then you'll be right back to the musical chairs. Also ahead in 14, you can see some other trust-funded areas in this initiative. And then I want to move on to housing. There is probably not a single issue that is more critical to our beneficiaries of all different descriptions and types than housing. You know, there's a lot of conversation right now about mental health issues and the safety of the community. You know, we walk a fine line between not wanting to reinforce the stigma that mentally ill people are somehow inherently more dangerous than anybody else. Statistically, people with mental illness are not significantly more prone to violence than the regular community. However, they are significantly more likely to be victims. Now, what's the single most important thing that you could do to enhance the safety of our beneficiaries in the community? And that is to work on the housing issue. It is so difficult to get our beneficiaries into housing. And the chart on the right of this slide is a perfect example. If you're on SSI and state supplement, you're making about $12,000 a year. If you're working a minimum wage job, which for a lot of our beneficiaries is a good thing, but they're not likely to move much farther beyond that, you're at $16,000. Well, the cost of living for a studio apartment and food and everything else is $28,000. It is extremely challenging. And if you think it's hard to get housing in places like Anchorage and Fairbanks, try going into villages or regional hubs where getting suitable housing is just absolutely critical. And I know there's been a lot of dividends paid by AHFC, but most of that has ended up going in the general fund, not being reinvested to dealing with the housing issues of the state. So we certainly see this as one of the most critical areas to continue to focus on.
Oh, Senator Bishop, thank you for your presentation. I would you can come back offline, but if you could just provide me with communities by the state with the worst chronic homeless populations, I'd appreciate that if you have that.
Absolutely, Senator. We do have that information, and I'll Nancy Burke, my housing program officer, is also behind me. I'm sure she is taking notes.
Thank you.
We'll get that to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Senator Bishop. Go ahead, Jeff.
So, again, formula for success. You're going to get tired of hearing this. Well, what do we do when we need to deal with a housing issue? Well, the first thing we do is we start pulling together our partners and start working with them. Of course, in this area, we're fortunate to have the partnership and leadership of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. You know, we work very closely with Dan Fowsky and appreciate his efforts as chair of the Council on the Homeless for the state. So we've been working very hard in the housing area. This just gives you an idea of just how serious the need is. When you look at the most vulnerable adults, these numbers are not going down significantly, even though we have added some programs such as Housing First projects in Anchorage and Fairbanks, and ones on the drawing board here for Juneau.
I'm glad you mentioned that. My staffer behind me just asked me to ask about Housing First models. So could you expand on that just a little bit?
I certainly could. You know, for years, when people looked at folks with chronic alcoholism that were chronically homeless, the strategy was to tell them, look, stop drinking and we'll get you housed, but we're not going to house you while you're still drinking. Well, that didn't work. Many of these individuals, we don't have the technology to make them sober, and so they ended up being homeless. Well, for a while, that was kind of okay, because at least for some policymakers, because they go, well, you know, they're homeless, that's fine. They're not costing us anything. If we provided them housing, we'd probably have to spend some money. We don't really want to spend money on these guys. We'll just let it go. Well, then folks started to actually follow some of these folks around and figure out, well, were they actually not costing anything or not? And it turns out they are very expensive. Where do they get their health care? At the ER, the most expensive place to get health care. When do they get health care? When they have a huge medical problem. Where else do they contact public services? Well, every time there's a man down call in Anchorage, the police are dispatched, the fire department is dispatched. Now you've got copious public safety resources being applied to these individuals. So finally somebody said, well, heck, why don't we just try housing them first and see what happens? Now it's a little controversial because people went, well, wait a minute, you're going to let these guys keep drinking? But some folks tried it, and the results are pretty staggering. And it exploded a lot of myths about this population. In Seattle, for example, when they developed a Housing First project, a couple of the myths that were out there is, well, these people choose to drink. This is a lifestyle choice. You know, we shouldn't be supporting that. Well, gosh, the people that got into Housing First in Seattle had been through treatment unsuccessfully an average of 15 times. Now, if you keep going back for treatment and you're not able to get sober 15 times, that's not a person who wants to be an alcoholic. We just don't know how to get them there. The other myth was, well, they like camping. You know, you're out in the outdoors and, you know, it's really enjoyable to camp. You get a lot of that around Native Alaskans. Oh, yeah, yeah, they're good at camping. Well, you know, in Seattle, when they took the 100 most vulnerable people and the most expensive utilizers of services, and they offered them housing first, they had to go through 76 people to get 72 to agree to go into housing. And the other four follow not far behind. So these people don't want to live on the street. They don't want to be alcoholics, but we don't know how to fix it. What they found out when they housed them, however, is their health status improved. Their drinking actually went down over time. In fact, at the program in Anchorage, there's actually an AA group now. And individuals that have been chronically homeless for some of them decades are showing marked improvements. Now, of course, their health status is impaired, and there have been a couple of deaths, but they're not dying in a snowbank or under a bridge. They're in a place where they can get cost-effective medical treatment and the dignity of living somewhere that's reasonable. I will point out, too, there was a lot of resistance in that community, as those of you from Anchorage no doubt remember. You know, because they said, oh, no, this is going to be terrible. These people are going to be, you know, in our doorways, et cetera. And it turns out that's not the case at all. In fact, the biggest challenge for RuralCap in working with the folks that live at Carlick Manor is getting them out of their room, because what they tend to do is isolate, and they need to be drawn out into the community that's there. So that's Housing First. The Carlick Manor project is very successful. Fairbanks, Canada Chiefs Conference, has got a Housing First project in Fairbanks, and Juneau was looking at one here as well. Senator, does that answer your question?
Yes, it did. Thank you very much.
Again, you can see the strategic thinking. I'm not going to go through all this, but again, it's looking at how to increase the stock of supported housing. Looking at successful models that we've piloted, and then you can see the results. We do have a 10-year plan that the Alaska Council for the Homeless has been working on. Again, looking at these Housing First models, we're working with the mayor of Anchorage to relocate Carlick to a better location and actually expand. And I'm sure you'll be seeing that.
Jeff, could you pause just for a moment, Senator Bishop?
I appreciate your knowledge in your forthrightness. And this is something that's important to me. Do you have any anecdotal information? Or I just give you a case in point. A really good friend of my family's, they would be, they're alcoholic, chronic alcoholic. They would go undercover for 6 months in the winter, living on the street. But in the spring, they would come to my parents, and they'd take them to fish camp and be sober as a judge all summer, and a real asset to the process. And is there, you know, so is there any, do you have any of these other kind of stories where family or friends are helping this, you know, take a burden off the system, so to speak, even if it's only for 6 months, and what that cost savings might be to the state? Or do you hear any of that kind of thing?
Absolutely, Senator. You know, many families struggle with family members or even neighbors with these issues, and are often able and willing to provide support. But a lot of times they're overwhelmed. It's just too much. And that's always the challenge for us, and you as well, is how to provide the least support necessary for the natural systems to be able to support their loved ones and neighbors, rather than trying to always provide some sort of cradle-to-grave programs that, oh, you got a problem, that's okay, there's a government program here, you just go in there and we'll take care of you. You're right. We want to support natural families and natural environments. And there are a lot of anecdotal evidences out there. And I'll tell you, one of the biggest things around alcoholism and drug abuse is sober housing. You know, it's so frustrating to see people work their tails off in treatment, get sober, and then when they leave treatment, they end up having to go right back into the same situation they were in before, you know, with the same issues around them, because there isn't any available sober housing in the community for them to be in, at least until they have enough sobriety under their belt that they can resist the temptations and work their plan. So there are a lot of anecdotal evidences out there. And again, bring the kids home is a good example. You know, we need to move down the chain so that we're supporting families, not taking kids and putting them in programs and facilities.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jeff, I want to stop your presentation here for just a little bit. I'd like to get maybe into a discussion if we could engage the other members of the committee as well. You know, chronic inebriation and the suicide and the health issues, mental health issues, homelessness, they're such a problem. And we see in rural Alaska, it seems to be heightened a little bit. Do you, as you're looking at your overall plan, do you create programs and a vision, for lack of a better word, do you create a vision that is informed by lack of money, or do you have a vision that fixes the problem? This is not a criticism at all. I would imagine if I were in your shoes and you come to the legislature year after year after year and you get a percentage of what you ask for, pretty soon you start nibbling around the edges. And I would also imagine a lot of that nibbling is fairly ineffective. My question would be, is there a model to fix this problem? Because you've got a committee on energy, and Senator Dunleavy has got throughput, and you're very involved with the suicide prevention, and on and on and on. But if we brought these things together and said, here's a fix, it's going to be expensive, like a legacy project almost. Do you have something like that?
Well, Senator Kelly, we do in the sense that each of our focus areas has a logic model and a system of developing strategies over time to achieve the ultimate outcomes. For many of these issues and problems, there are successful models out there. They're not all the same. You know, adult suicide prevention is often different than what we're trying to do with adolescents. You know, they're connected differently. They listen to different things. So there are those models out there. What we can do is to, again, pull the best minds together to identify the problem, identify the measurable outcome we're after, and develop strategies that we think are effective and cost efficient. In the end, though, it is beyond our means to implement all of those programs.
Oh, clearly, I sympathize with that.
Yeah, and I'm not suggesting that you suggested otherwise. You know, we learned a long time ago that the best service is not one that relies upon governmental funding, because you get a lot of issues when you get into relying on government funding, whether it's federal funding or state funding. So that's one of the reasons you'll see in a minute why we've emphasized peer-to-peer support is, look, people that are in recovery from mental illness or substance abuse can do a lot to support each other without a big government program.
Right.
And so we have to maximize those opportunities in rural Alaska. You know, we need to work with the cultural strengths that are there rather than try to impose some kind of a service system.
Have you guys ever thought of this, Senator Hoffman, I'll get right to you. As you were talking, it just something came to my mind. Jeff, I have a tremendous amount of respect for you. I think the first time I sat through one of your presentations was 18 years ago. And strangely, you don't look any different, but but you do a great job. I mean that. I have a lot of respect for you and your organization. But I would imagine all you people talk to each other. Have you ever thought of bringing in some killer entrepreneur who has no experience in the mental health field and say, how would you fix this? How would you create a plan to fix this? And then bring in the different elements so that you could tell him or her, no, that's a stupid idea, that won't work, or that would, and try to work to really thinking outside of the box, because I haven't been here for a while, but I tell you what, these are a lot of the same problems we were dealing with 18 years ago. And I'm sure a lot of money has been spent. And I would also bet that the people around this table and throughout this building would say, holy cow, we've spent all this money and nothing happens. It's your fault, Jeff, or Health and Social Services. I would be willing to entertain, you would get my support, let me put it this way, if you had an innovative model to fix the problem with a funding schedule. And I would think the place that you would have to start would be Western and Northwestern Alaska. You got some advocates here to fix the problem, then, and let's start putting it across the state. I worked in an office a few years ago. Coincidentally, there were like three or four suicides from the kids of these people. Good people. That didn't seem to be anything going wrong in their family. The people who committed suicide had serious drug problems. I see these numbers about suicide, and it's heartbreaking. And we continue to talk, and it seems, again, no criticism all, Jeff, we're nibbling around the edges. Can you guys go back and talk about something that would just kind of knock our socks off? And we'd tell you it's too expensive. Clearly, we would tell you that. But let's get the debate started on an answer that solves the problem regardless of our ability or willingness to fund it. Let's see a model that we can either say, I can support that, or I can't, and I'll suffer the criticism for not supporting it, because it sounds like a pretty good idea. Would you guys think about that? And the other question I would ask you, too, I'm probably going to step on some toes here, but are we discussing dry, damp, and those kinds of community issues? And Senator Hoffman, is Bethel a... Bethel is not an open community, is it?
It is. It's a... Bethel... unlike Bethel and Kotzebue have voted to lift the ban.
Oh, they have.
But the council has said to the Beverage Control Board they don't want any licenses issued, which they have, the board has acknowledged. But I would say that because Bethel has voted to lift the ban, if there was a lawsuit filed in Bethel, whoever did that would get the license, because there is no laws to say where Bethel's at, you know, which is you're a wet community, but the Alcohol Beverage Control Board has acknowledged the wishes of the council and the community to say we want to be able to import as much alcohol as we want, but we don't want it sold in our community, and we don't want beer or wine. But that, Mr. Chairman, that brings me to the the question. We, Kotzebue and Bethel have been damp for 20 years, and now they've made changes because the problems continue to persist. And, you know, I've talked to several students that went up to Fairbanks, and they say, well, you know, I came from a dry community, and when I asked my elders why we're damp or why we're dry, the vast majority of the communities around Bethel are dry. They say because when we drink, we can't handle alcohol. So that, you know, as that child grows up and then he becomes of drinking age and then he leaves the confines of a community that is dry, he goes to University of Alaska in Fairbanks and he starts to drink, you know. And what has he learned all his life? When I drink, when my people drink, they can't handle alcohol. So guess what's going to happen? You know, it's self-evident. And the other problem, I guess, is that with the bootlegging problem, even though Bethel is wet, and there still is bootlegging in many of the places out there. So when somebody comes to Bethel and buys a bottle of alcohol for $100, when they finish half of it, you know, that's probably enough. But they know that they have to go back to their community. So what do? They finish it all. You know, they're not going to throw it away, and they go back to their, because they can't go bring right. that alcohol to the dry community that yeah. they're in. And therein lies, I think, a different problem. There's several different problems. And what are the solutions? Bethel and Kotzebue have struggled with it and for 20 years, but decided to take a different course to, you know, maybe there's a place where you can say that you'd have licenses for beer or wine so that people can be in a setting where it's more social, that they say that they're eating while they're drinking instead of when you get alcohol in from a bootlegger, all you're going to do is drink. So there are changes taking place, the results of which are unknown at this point, I think, in Kotzebue and in Bethel. Are we going to see more people incarcerated in Kotzebue and in Bethel since this is a new phenomenon that's happened within the last 18 months, or aren't we? And I don't know if, you know, if Mr. Jesse, you're looking at that, and what are we going to learn from these two different experiences in two major hubs? You know, we only have like five or six major hubs in the state of Alaska. Bethel and Kotzebue are a couple of the largest ones.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Senator Meyer, and then Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Jesse, thank you for your presentation. I don't know, we kind of got off on a different tangent here, but I think what is clear is obviously mental health, mental illness is a very complex issue, and I'm not convinced that there is a model out there that will prevent all mental illness. Some of this, like Alzheimer's and even alcoholism, is inherited, but there are, and you know, traumatic brain damage can happen to any of us anytime, car wreck, football, whatever the case may be. But certainly, and you know, I've done quite a bit of work in the area of fetal alcohol syndrome. That is totally preventable, and whether it be the alcohol or be drug abuse, and you know, we've done such a good job, I think, in educating people on the hazards of tobacco, much less tobacco use now, on the hazards of driving while drinking, much less DUIs now. What have you been doing, and the state is obviously responsible to try to educate age-bearing women to not drink or you know, now I'm hearing the drug of choice is heroin, which just totally blows me away, to not do these drugs during the 9 months of pregnancy.
Mr. Jesse?
And then also maybe, you know, if you can, if you have any statistics that show that if we can prevent, in this case, women from not drinking, not doing drugs, and these kids and having the mental disorders from that, how much that saves the state? Because obviously, that child from when they're born to when they die is costing the state a ton of money.
Senator, through the chair, I want to answer that question, but if you don't mind, first I'd like to go back to the conversation that Senator Kelly started.
Certainly.
Let me have one of my trustees. You hear from me all the time. Let me bring one of my trustees up and let you talk directly to Russ Webb. Would that be?
Can I take just a brief at ease? And Senator Fairclough, before you do that, Senator Fairclough had a question. Would you go ahead?
Mr. Chairman, it's not a comment, or it's not a question, it was a comment,
Oh, go ahead.
A couple comments. One, just for the record, at least in Anchorage, anecdotally I've heard at least from businesses around the Carlick Manor, and they believe it's a challenge, which is why the city is working towards relocating the facility, and the business owners that are around there, I believe, are trying to come together to buy that facility. But that said, I appreciate the program. I appreciate the clients who have chosen to live there and who are trying to make better choices in their lives. On, Mr. Chairman, what you've said, Mr. Jesse might be the right place to go as the convener, but this is not just a mental health issue. This is an Alaska issue, and we, I think that in our effort to try to solve one problem, we could solve many problems. We can't take the issue of Alaska's health on in a silo manner with just looking at mental health. We're highest in the nation for suicide, rape, domestic violence, child abuse, child maltreatment, neglect, inhalants. It's really about, as Senator Meyer pointed out, having people aware that they're hurting themselves generationally, that the choices they're making today are impacting the children and the lives around them, as well as the future parents of our next generation. And so I absolutely am willing to invest in a primary prevention look at all of these issues, because if we build another sobriety center, which we may need to do, so that we can have crisis intervention for those that are affected today, we're still not backing up to the primary prevention that Mr. Jesse spoke about. And so I would just say we do need a campaign to talk to Alaskans, but do we need a campaign to talk about all of Alaska going dry? Do we need, I know that isn't going to be palatable to the general public. I certainly wouldn't suggest it. But the issue is, how do you make it a highlighted issue so that people understand the negative impacts that are happening across our communities from drugs that are being illegally taken but available to our children and now sold over the internet in names like bath salts and other things where kids don't even know that the drug may kill them on one dose. And so, Mr. Chairman, I support a look, and I certainly support Mr. Jesse and the trustees being a convener, but Alaska needs to look at primary prevention on a multitude of issues that our state is plagued with. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I couldn't agree more. I'm going to take just a brief at ease, okay? Chatty group here. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Russell Webb. I'm the trustee of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. I cannot tell you how heartened I am about the conversation that you've just been having. It is among the most insightful conversations I have heard in 30 years of being before the legislature. You seem to have a grasp that it is better than I have ever seen. You're exactly right, Senator Fairclough. A narrow approach will not work. We have to take an extended, broad-based approach to preventing kids from being involved with alcohol and drugs, changing the, giving those kids resilience, helping, giving them information. We also have to have treatment available to parents who, as, and I can tell you from my own personal knowledge, having worked in the child protection system, 70-some percent of the cases in the child protection system, alcohol or drugs are a contributing, if not the primary contributing factor to the abuse or neglect that occurs. The same thing in the criminal justice system. What we don't have is treatment available immediately at the time when people are most willing for treatment. As at the Trust, what we have been attempting to do, and you can see in these focus areas, is look at the large, complex, intractable, and long-standing problems that exist in this state around our mission, and to try to use what resources we have to make a difference, and to make those resources, to focus those resources over time, because these large intractable problems take time and they take continued resource investment. They won't just take hours, they take general fund monies as well, federal monies as well. But as Jeff has noted, what the Trust has been able to do is we have flexibility with our funding. We can serve as a good convener, and we can look for and find good ideas and help others implement those ideas and try to give the best advice to you that we can possibly give. Your suggestion, Senator Kelly, that we look at trying to find a solution, not just a short-term fix, is exactly where we want to go. But it'll be a broad-based solution. There is no silver bullet. There's no quick fix. It'll be an extended investment over time of our money and the state's money. I'm only one trustee, but I think I can speak for others. That's the commitment we want to make to you and to the state. We are looking for something that is not necessarily our legacy, but the legacy of the state of Alaska in making life better for all Alaskans. And I cannot tell you how heartened I am to hear the discussion here today. And I believe, on behalf of trustees, that we will commit to you that we will work on this problem. We will make it a focus area, and we will bring to you a broad-based approach that looks over an extended period of time. We're going to be investing money on a wide array of fronts around this issue for 10, 12 years if we really want to make a difference. And that difference, as you know, will not happen overnight. Prevention doesn't, the impacts of a good prevention effort don't show up tomorrow. They show up 10 years later as a 10-year-old kid becomes a 20-year-old kid and doesn't end up in jail. So we will all have to be smart and patient in how we look at this and look at it over the long term. And, we will work with you to the best degree we can, and we will bring you every year some good ideas. But we'll, Senator, we'll do the best we can to develop a broad-based approach and tell you about that before we ever come to you with implementation plans.
Thank you. I hope you will look at pulling this together almost like a legacy project for the state of Alaska. Just wrote down my notes. You know, we have an electrical problem in the rail belt, and so we talk about building the Susitna Dam. If we were going to be long-term reluctant to actually build that dam, we'd do silly things like build diesel plants all over the place. So I'm not interested in the diesel plant fix, okay?
Nor am I.
And the other thing I'm not interested in is a fix that has rejected so many ideas because of political correctness. Now, I love your community, and you guys are brilliant on dealing with these problems, but I don't want you just talking to each other, because that's not going to get anything more than maybe a glorified example of what we already have. Pull in some people from the outside, pull in people who don't think like you. As I had that suggestion, find some entrepreneur, somebody that's built a dot-com empire or something, and say, we have people dying in snowbanks and killing themselves in portions of Alaska at an outrageous rate, and we need a fix, and we think you might have some ideas to help us fix that. It's a little bit of dreaming, but, you know, Susitna is dreaming. Pipelines are dreaming. Let's dream this. And there was a great quote I heard one time. It is that... to do the impossible, you must think the absurd. All right, so go someplace and think the absurd and see if you can do the impossible.
We're not afraid of ideas that don't belong to us.
Okay. We're getting pretty late here. Jeff, could you wrap this up fairly quick?
How much time do you want me to use?
Well, we have some members that have some appointments. Can you do this in maybe 10 minutes?
Uh-huh.
Okay, let's do that.
Let me, though, quickly get back to Senator Meyer's question about, if I understood it, fetal alcohol syndrome and prevention efforts. You know, the state does have a actually pretty comprehensive prevention program around FAS. They had a federal earmark several years ago, and they actually have a state incentive grant right now that's looking at these prevention-type things. So there are activities going on. But as Russ said, you know, one of the things that we're going to have to take a look at if you want to make progress in this area are some social norms. There are a lot of ways in which we as a society reinforce, particularly in the area of alcohol, reinforce that as a key part of our culture. And I'll just quickly give you an anecdote. I went to the opening of a health center. And as I walked in and got my name tag and was looking for the shrimp, the good stuff, here's a big wine bar and a keg of beer in a health center. And I wasn't going to say anything because, as many of you know, I'm a recovering alcoholic, and there's nothing like a recovering anything. But as I was sitting there, the two young people that were about to serve had a conversation, and one of them said, you know, this is great because I used to work for an outfit that wouldn't allow you to have alcohol at a function like this. And this is terrific. And I, you know, me, I couldn't help myself. I interrupted. I said, I'm sorry, but I don't think this is that terrific. Do you know how many people come into this health center as a result of alcohol issues? And this young woman looked at me and said, well, this is Alaska. And I said, well, maybe that's the problem. And she says, well, I don't think so. You know, that's got to be part of the problem. I mean, just this last year, the legislature agreed to move the Alcohol Beverage Control Board from the Department of Public Safety to Commerce and Economic Development. And why did that happen? Because the industry didn't want to be treated like criminals. They wanted to be recognized for the positive economic engine that they are and be in a department that will promote them rather than regulate them. So, in any event, I will move forward. Looking ahead in FY14, you know, obviously for housing, we'll be looking at continuing to get resources for housing issues. I'll point out on page 29, the governor did reduce the request for funding for homeless programs. So that's also something that we'll be discussing in subcommittee and as the capital budget starts to move forward. In our opinion, we need additional resources in housing not reductions. So we'll be looking at that as well. Workforce development is another focus area. We've worked very closely with the Department of Labor. This is a tremendous issue for us, no matter what programs you have. If you don't have a stable, educated workforce you can retain, you're not going anywhere. So we've worked very hard looking at healthcare job growth, how we can be helpful in advancing this cause. Healthcare is a leading employer in the state. So this is an area of employment growth, and we need these workers in our area as well. Again, we pull our partners together, including the Departments of Labor, Education, Health and Social Services, the university. You can see the list. In fact, later today, one of my trustees and Delisa Culpepper, my chief operating officer who heads up this area, are going to go meet with the Department of Labor and talk further about how we can strengthen that partnership. So, and again, looking at the different strategic actions in this area, looking at what the occupational priorities are, and looking at what kind of systems change and capacity building that we can put in place, things like loan repayment, better access to training, professional development, you can see the list. Results for the beneficiaries, you can see the really very significant increase in getting people trained and into this workforce over the last several years. So we're going to continue to work on expanding this area as well. Looking ahead at FY14, we're going to be looking at the results of the vacancy study that was done, look at developing a graduate certificate in marriage and family therapy at the university, and then looking for a permanent home within the university for non-academic training and professional development for health careers. It isn't just about getting people degrees. It's keeping them up to speed with the latest technology, not just gizmos, but the latest strategies for intervening. You can see also then ahead for FY14 on slide 37 what we're looking at for a budget for the next fiscal year. You can see there were a couple of areas that we were unable to get the support of the governor for, and that's something that we will also be talking to the subcommittees about working on during the process. I'll touch very briefly on beneficiary projects. I mentioned this a little bit earlier. You know, we believe that beneficiaries can do a lot to help each other. They don't necessarily always have to have a paid professional looking over their shoulder. And so we've done a lot of work in supporting peer-to-peer services and getting peer-to-peer support to be an integral part of our service delivery system. There's now a certification program for people to become peer support specialists, and programs can actually bill for their services. So we're very excited about that. You can see how we have developed our strategic thinking in this area around technical assistance, training, peer support workforce, and integrating them into the service delivery system. Another program of the trust I'll touch on very briefly are mini grants. These are grants to individual beneficiaries of up to $2,500 for things they think would improve their quality of life. Interestingly, even though dental is a part of the Medicaid program, a very large proportion of the requests for this money continue to be dental care.
Jeff, can I interrupt you there? I was in a conversation with some owners of a business in Alaska. It was one of the surgical centers. And they had said that they had done 1,200 replacements, almost like full dental plate replacements, just in their facility in the last year, for pediatric dental care. And I wasn't aware of the associated health problems with that. One of them is asthma. I don't know if you guys knew that, but one of the problems that will happen from really poor dental care is they're aspirating the, is that the right word, the bacteria I think that's the right word. Anyway, they're inhaling the bacteria, and then, of course, their lungs react. I was shocked at that, and many other health problems are related to it, yes. Heart problems, those kinds of things. And one surgical center, 1,200, what's going on?
Well, Senator, one thing that's going on is if people don't have access to preventive care and early care, then they end up needing major work that's very expensive. So that's one thing. And I'll tell you, people are having a problem if you offer them $2,500 and the main thing they want to do is go to the dentist. I don't know about you guys, but going to the dentist isn't way up on my list of options for a day off.
Just so you know, this was pediatric dental care. I mean, you don't associate full replacements with pediatric.
We've been very supportive of the dental health aid program, by the way, which is a fantastic program to deliver dental care in rural areas that just are not going to get dentists out there.
Go ahead.
So moving on to small projects.
We're running out of time, Jeff. So
yes, I'm moving as fast as I can here. Grants of $10,000 each. Those are often more effective dollar for dollar than many of our larger grants. Again, you'll see the budget for the beneficiary projects. The only GF request we have is a relatively modest $25,000 for microenterprise small business capital. We want you to be a part of this. You know, beneficiaries can create businesses and make money, and we think you need to be a part of that as well. And again, our two legislative priorities, long-term support services for people with disabilities, and as Senator Kelly mentioned, the Complex Behaviors Collaborative, that is just still getting underway, and we'll be looking for some support to continue to see if that is going to be a cost-effective way of dealing with these complex behaviors. We'll be taking that up with Senator Olson. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is refreshing to hear a holistic approach and support for that approach from those affected. And I would just throw out that I'm wondering if this committee might sponsor a bill that creates a task force so that we might be actively involved in the conversation about how Alaska might take up primary prevention to be able to meet the needs with crisis intervention in the form of looking at short-term solutions and long-term solutions. The reason I suggest that is there are partners across Alaska. The Rasmussen Foundation comes to mind, that should the state be willing to step up with a particular amount of money, that we might be able to utilize that along with other agencies that might want to work for primary prevention solutions to do that. I just would throw that out for the committee's consideration so that we might be part of solving a major issue for Alaska.
Senator Meyer and I will talk about a committee bill this afternoon if we have time. What I'd like to is for, we have, Dr. Senator Olson to be deeply involved in this, and Senator Hoffman, your experience in rural Alaska, he's an entrepreneur, you're probably the most successful businessman the Senate has ever had. People probably don't know that, but I'd like for the two of you to be involved in that as well. And again, don't gild the lily, but give us something that we can hold and show people. This is something that's moving in Alaska, and let's try to fix as many of these problems as we can, because it's not working. And you guys are trying pretty hard, I know that. And you're fighting us all the time regarding funding, because our funding decreases. But at the same time, we do have conversations in the environment of decreased funding for the big projects. And I would like us to just begin to think of this in that same vein. Obviously, the founders of the state were considering this to be kind of a big legacy thing, or they wouldn't have created the mental health trust in the first place. Any questions from the committee? Any other comments? Jeff, would you do me a favor? I'm going to be having lunch this afternoon down at the hangar. If you're running around and could make it there, I'd like you to talk to some people that I'm having lunch with. They work a lot with suicide prevention, specifically in rural Alaska. And do you know of a gentleman named Bill Pegran?
No, I don't.
He's a musician, and he also does I can't remember the name of it. It's Run for the Cure or Cause for the I can't remember. He goes on the Iditarod Trail. He's a great musician. He's got a plays with a band called Broken Walls. Anyway, he has got a real heart for suicide prevention in rural Alaska for youth. I'd like to put you guys together and start thinking with on the same lines that they are thinking, and I'm sure you already are. But at noon, if you have time to just run down to the hangar, I'd like you to meet these folks and
I'll be there.
Let them bend your ear a little bit, and maybe vice versa. Other comments or questions from the community? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the questions have been in the back of my mind. I probably should have asked earlier. What's the interaction between the private efforts that you're putting forth and the Alaska Native beneficiaries that are out there? When you have two separate systems that are out there, one more oriented toward federal, how do they interact?
Well, Senator Olson, through the chair, that's a lot of, frankly, what we do is trying to connect the two.
Sure.
The state.
So they are complementary.
They could be a lot more complementary than they are. There are joint efforts underway, but there's room for a lot of improvement there. I regularly attend the tribal behavioral health directors meetings, Native Health Board.
I have a meeting in my office and we can try and put those efforts.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Chairman. Happy to do that.
Okay. We're going to wrap it up. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Jeff, it's good to see you again. We're adjourned.